previously on Geth in the Mecha. That is probably in summary why I think the Sheen arc is quite great. It's discovering this new concept, or bringing back an old concept, and refreshing it, bringing back not only the Sharingan, but even the Akatsuki and the Taka. It's stripped down all the ninjutsu, stripped down all the powers. How strong can our characters be on a one-on-one basis? This is Geth in the Mecha, the weekly anime and manga show where we take things one step further. I analyze everything from arcs to OPs to episodes in my wacky but enjoyable quest to make sense of all of it. Welcome back to Geth in the Mecha, I'm your host Shamar today, and in this absurdly late episode, I apologize, we are discussing the Momoshiki arc of Boruto. So in this episode, we're kind of just going back to basics, looking at how the narrative is structured, how this works as a legacy arc. I discussed a lot of this, or part of it, maybe in not so much detail, within my Boruto at 100 episode, which you can check out. That was one of my first episodes, really. And then some Sakuga from the Holy episode 65. So if you do enjoy this episode, feel free to leave a review, whether that's on iTunes, your iOS device, or wherever you do get your podcasts. It would be greatly appreciated and helps share the love of Get in the Mecha. And the last thing before we get into this episode, I actually have two announcements. I'll be really brief about them. The first one is that in a few weeks, I will be doing a two-part podcast series known as Dread and the Sublime. That will basically be a two-part analysis of Takahata's Studio Ghibli film, The Grave of Fireflies. We'll be looking into not only its philosophical context, but looking at the inspiration behind it and what it does for the film. It'll be an intimate one as well, because we'll be looking at history and some more pressing matters. And then the second one is that this will probably be next month, I believe. I will be producing a three-part mini-series known as Beyond Konoha. Beyond Konoha is going to be a mini-series where I look at Kishimoto Musashi's manga besides Naruto, as he's often shaped by that and given that brand as the guy that made Naruto. So I decided to explore three of his one-shot manga, which people don't really speak about that much. We'll be looking at Karakuri, Mario, and Bench, as well as we'll be looking a bit at some insights in regards to Kishimoto as a mangaka and a creative. And without further ado, here is the episode for this week. That is episode 34 of Geth in the Mecha, the Momoshiki arc. Just to clarify, for this episode, I've basically watched all the different forms, or at least all the different forms I know of, to consume this arc. So I have seen the movie, which contained this arc, basically. I have read the manga for this arc, and I have watched the anime. And so, just to get to my alerts while we're on the topic of this, spoilers for chapters 1 to 10 of the Boruto manga, as well as spoilers for episodes 52 to 66 of the Boruto anime. And in that case, also, spoilers for the movie as well, because that basically does contain this arc and it is quite similar. There are a few differences and I might not discuss that in depth, but if you are willing to watch this film, we will be discussing its contents today. I know this episode is coming out late already, so I'm not going to waste any more time. Here is a plot summary of the Momoshiki arc. The beginning of this arc sees Sasuke aggravate the Otsutsuki family members which remain after Kaguya's defeat in Naruto Shippuden. Sasuke engages in a fight between Momoshiki and Kinshiki Otsutsuki in the Ice Dimension, only for them to find out that Kaguya is now dead. Back at the village, the new Team 7, Boruto, Sarada, and Mitsuki prepare for the Chunin exams, and Boruto, being the son of Naruto, who feels like he gets a lack of recognition, decides to use a cheating device known as a Shinobi Gauntlet. After being able to clear all the rounds and actually winning the tournament, Boruto is then discovered for cheating. But simultaneously, Momoshiki and Kinshiki arrive to disrupt the exams. After managing to capture Naruto, the four other Kage, Sasuke, and Boruto, who tags along, are now tasked to save Naruto, In an explosive fight, they manage to take him and Kinshiki down, but in the process, Boruto receives a parting gift from Momoshiki, a mark on his palm known as Karma. And so, the arc concludes. So that is the arc. It sounds very familiar, and I think that is on purpose. This is a format which we're used to in how we get Chunin exam, disruption to the Chunin exam, massive consequences as a result of a big fight. Nothing new, but also I think that, as I said, is something which is intentional, which is worked on within this arc. I think the reason for mirroring such a format isn't because, we just want to reproduce something, but I think it pays homage to all the people who've actually stood by this show for a long time. And yeah, it is a safe option to do, but also it can come with its benefits as well. The main difference is that we have this new component in the arc, and that is this cheating component. This is one which we've never actually been that used to, since, as if we go to the Naruto franchise obviously, technology wasn't a very big thing, or at least there weren't many technological advancements. They were good and pretty well developed village, but technology wasn't something which was a massive part of that, or at least digital technology anyway. We only really see that emerge out of stuff like Naruto the Last, when that technology comes in, when they have the watch device thing and all of that. That is when things start to develop, which I actually do appreciate now a lot more, but that isn't really the case until Boruto. I think the cheating part of this arc, or the cheating element of this arc, does create somewhat of a hook, and it's constantly making us, or at least me as an audience member, consider when is he going to get caught, when is this not going to be acceptable, and also how dire the consequences will be. I think there's another lesson which comes out this arc, which I think I'll get to after I explain the rest of the things. But I actually think, now I'm reconsidering this arc, this isn't something I really looked at that much when I initially watched it, but when reconsidering it, I think that the cheating part of it does actually have a decent amount of relevance, and it's not just to introduce us to new technology, which part of it is, and it's not just addressing the lack of recognition, but actually has a lesson when we look at the other side of the arc as well. So this other part of the arc addresses the legacy of Naruto Shippuden, and the legacy of this story, as it's been over 700 episodes of which it's been going for. It manages to insert a key element from Naruto Shippuden and tie that thread into Boruto, which is a really important thing. There is an argument, and I don't really agree with it, there is an argument that Kaguya should have been introduced into Boruto. I disagree with that, and I'll tell you why, and this kind of factors into this arc in general. I think the reason for that specifically is because when we look at Kaguya as an antagonist, particularly within Naruto Shippuden, she is the underlying factor behind the show and behind everything. She is chakra in its essence, almost, or the closest thing. She is the closest thing besides the Sage of the Six Paths that represents chakra as is. And as we know, within the Naruto Shippuden, Boruto series, chakra is a concept which, one, us viewers are very used to, because us as viewers or readers have been used to this for hundreds of chapters or hundreds of episodes at least. And so I think it's only right to address the core of it all. And so the defeat of Kaguya sets something in motion, which I think Boruto can latch onto. Now we've addressed what is the source of everything. Now it's really trying to understand what is the further problem. What is the need for these almost chakra founders to be hunting us down? It also, as I said previously, just adds an element of familiarity. I don't think it would be very right for introducing an antagonist that's completely new, that is the foundation of chakra itself within Boruto. Because of that thematic importance, and Kaguya's thematic importance, and decent disconnects to the rest of the narrative in how she obviously came out of Madara. Madara being this almost transition phase villain, Kaguya being the ends of everything, the thematic ends being chakra, having such a heavy concept and thematic weight within Boruto just wouldn't be a nice way to ease into it. And so having the Otsutsukis, which aren't particularly Kaguya in itself, is just a nice way to start an anime, or a manga at least. It's almost like on the first day of school when you get a test, and the test is really hard, it's nothing you've studied. you kind of just wouldn't be like, what the heck, this isn't fair. That, I think, would be if Kaguya was introduced into Boruto. It just wouldn't be very, it would create too much of a disconnect and too much of a rift between the series. And so Kaguya sets in motion what Boruto tries to accomplish in its Momoshiki arc, and I think that's done relatively successfully. If we continue on this thread of familiarity, I think the arc does a mixture of both, or at least it tries to combine some things which we know, and then introduce them in a slightly more skewed way. That aspect is also just a good way of introducing us to slightly newer concepts, or changing what we thought we knew, so it doesn't feel as if we're watching the Chunin exams plus the Kaguya arc again, basically, in Boruto. I think a good example of this would be the designs and powers and abilities of the Otsutsuki, specifically Momoshiki. So the Rinnegan in his hand, that being a golden one, I don't know if there's a difference, I'm not going to go into that. That, I think, is a really good example, as well as the Rinnegan on his head as well. We are used to the Rinne Sharingan, but I think the main concept or takeaway from that is just the power system as well as ability system, which we've discovered in the likes of Naruto and Naruto Shippuden, is still evolving, and there's still so much more out there. Momoshiki in himself is proof that the legacy of Kaguya is nowhere near gone, and Kaguya was just the beginning of everything. As I said earlier, Kaguya has set everything in motion for this new age of difference and craziness, almost. This notion of difference is also carried through within our antagonists, specifically Naruto and Sasuke. We are, again, used to what they can do, specifically because of the end game of Shippuden versus Madara in the war arc. But once again, that is distorted by these newer forms. So a good example would be the Susanoo Armored Kurama. That was one really cool to see for the first time in the movie. I was very shocked, but it was insane to watch. So it just adds an element of what you can call hype. But it also shows that there is life in this franchise, or at least it's trying to show that there is life within this franchise. There is more to explore. There is more that can be done with these characters. The way I'm alluding to it, I think we can potentially say that this is almost like the tutorial or the demo arc of the show. It just shows us that there is a lot more to be done. It's quick, it's not over the top, and what it tries to do is just show us the difference between what the world was and what it is now. One of those lessons I think we get from Boruto, specifically if we continue discussing this thing on how this franchise is new, if anything, there's one theme. I think I just contradicted myself there briefly, but I think there is one theme which maintains itself, or at least it tries to say the same, or cancels itself out to say that although this new age has come, this is one thing which simply will not work or shouldn't work within this era. And that one thing is cheating. I think Naruto, as an anime, did try to teach us this lesson, and it's a lot more extended, but also it kind of is applied within its own Chunin exam arc. And it's this endless pursuit for power. At least we see that within characters such as Orochimaru, and how they are seeking out characters such as Sasuke in order for Sharingan eyes, because of that drive for more, that drive to become a better shinobi and assert your dominance, that sort of thing. That is kind of mirrored within Boruto, and we see that within Momoshiki and himself. Through his consumption of these, what the wiki calls chakra edible creations, I'm intending to put those in the show notes. They seem to be chakra fruit, or if you're just a One Piece nut, basically devil fruits, whatever. And those in themselves emulate this almost unfair notion that you can become powerful by just consuming this one thing. It almost has like a sports doping feel to it. It doesn't feel fair, and I think that's the point. Obviously, the gang and everyone's able to take him down either way, but that endless pursuit of power is shown not to work for either Boruto or even Momoshiki. And I think one thing which is passed on, and this is probably one of the core values of Naruto as well as Boruto, it's if you want to become powerful, you must hone your powers, and you must train, and you must develop as a person, and care for those around you, rather than simply believing that you can consume this device, rather than assuming that you can consume this pill, or use this device and you'll be okay. Technology or anything is not an easy way out. Even in a world where there wasn't so much technology in the likes of Naruto, it wasn't an easy way out for anyone. that is probably the main source of Sasuke's downfall anyway. It's this constant pursuit of power to the extent where does it end? Where does one feel satisfied with themselves? And Sasuke didn't feel satisfied. Someone like Itachi, I think, taught him that. And Itachi taught him that through defeating Kabuto in the war arc. I think these are all messages and parallels which, although not explicit, are kind of refracted into Boruto somehow. So I think that is most of the narrative analysis for this week. The Momoshiki arc, just to summarize, is quite a simple arc in how it's structured. It's nothing too complicated and it's familiar. However, it does manage to adapt some of the things which we are used to, and is very referential to its legacy shows such as Naruto and Naruto Shippuden, demonstrating that the endless pursuit of power simply is futile and doesn't work. And so this leads us now to the Sakuga section of today's podcast. This is something I've been really excited for. I've been learning about Sakuga for a really long time now, well, not really a long time, but my knowledge of Sakuga has definitely improved and increased. I've always understood like shots and cinematography, but when it comes to Sakura itself, I've been learning and learning and grinding really hard to try and understand it. And now I think I've come to a good place where I'm willing to analyze and truly understand what's going on in the sense of technicalities. And so I want to share that with you guys today. Just one more thing. I think it's really cool how I'm not really trying to boast about myself, but through doing the podcast, I've learned so much between the last time I talked about Boruto and now that I'm talking about Boruto. And so I just think there's been a lot of development in my knowledge, which I'm really excited to share. So the main point of Sakuga I want to discuss is episode 65. And this is the fight between none other than Naruto and Sasuke versus Momoshiki. The names I need to mention for the cuts I'm specifically discussing, though there are quite a few members of the team working on this, and obviously credit to Period who is doing this, as well as the guest animators. The names I have to mention are Till Finning, Wellen Zhang, and Cheng Sui Huang. Wellen Zhang and Cheng Sui Huang are two of which I mentioned Zhang at least in my Boruto at 100 episode, but I'm discussing him now because I think since then there's been so much development within his animation, and we've seen him on so many works long past that now. And I've identified him and seen him on so many works past that and past Boruto even. I think this was the way I learned about Wellen Zhang from this arc, and then I saw his work in Mob Psycho 100 episode 5 or Mob Psycho 102 episode 5, his recent work on FGO, which was insane, his work on Kara on Tuesday, Cannon Busters. He's been doing loads of things, and I haven't even seen all of these shows, but at least through what I've seen of his work, it's just coming along so well. Zhang's knowledge of the concept of the fight, and I don't just mean it within Boruto, I just mean that in general, fighting as a concept and as a technical piece of work almost, I think is just crazy, and he's been able to emulate that so well. I was looking at one of his previous works, and that was known as Shine Time, using stuff like colored impact frames. It's not new, I don't believe, but this isn't something we see a lot of. Even just the transformation throughout that short work are just crazy. And so I want to get into Zhang's cut specifically, and then we'll look at, and then I want to look a bit at Till Finning's cuts and what that does, and overall what this does for the show, as well as this section of the episode. So there are a lot of shifting perspectives in this fight. Till Finning also helps with that in regards to depth. Again, I'll discuss that later. So there are a lot of changing perspectives within this fight. We get the point of view shots when looking right at Momoshiki. We get these side angle shots specifically when we're fighting Momoshiki when Naruto is fighting Momoshiki. And there's almost rugged camera movement that doesn't feel still. It's actually always moving, and then there's emphasis on the knee movement. I don't think this is completely intentional. Well, it is intentional for the camera movement, but what I'm going to say I don't think is intentional. But when we have the scientist, I honestly forgot his name right now, but I'm on a roll. When we get the scientist filming the events, I don't know if he comes on time, but I think that might be a good example or maybe a reference to that, because with the camera, this invisible camera tracking everything, it's even able to track the knee going into Momoshiki. I think Momoshiki manages to catch that. But that attention to detail as well, I think is just one which Zhang has so much of. Also just his ways of conveying fluidity within the fight, I think is a really important thing. So this is something I don't think has a name specifically, but at least the eyeline tracking of Sasuke his Sharingan. This is something which we also saw back in the conclusion to Naruto Shippuden as well. But anyway, that eyeline tracking is just really important for just showing how energetic and speedy this fight is. Also by portraying them as light beams as opposed to literally seeing them run around. That also I would believe to be a technical choice, which is just really interesting because it's portraying them literally as light. They are speed. And I don't mean that in the meme sense. They are literally speed. Something that I've said in my Sakuga episode back in the 20s. When I say 20s, I mean episode 20s. I can't remember numbers anymore. But when we looked at understanding Sakuga, I spoke about how Sakuga in itself needs thematic weight in order to thrive. And this most definitely has thematic weight to it. And I think we can also say the reverse. It gives it an extra level of portrayal, at least gives it an extra layer of meaning to take from it, because now, because of Zhang's animations, we now have a new understanding as to the speed of which this fight is going at and the rapidity of this one battle. We can also say this adds a level of conviction as well, seriousness to it, just by emphasizing that one Sharingan movement, especially when he's jumping within the air. That, I think, is almost the focal point of that one shot. We don't get it all the time, and so I think its emphasis is one which is definitely made intentional and signposted by Zhang himself. And now if we look a bit at Till Finning's cuts, they're able to add a lot more depth to everything by the end in how, when we get Naruto and Sasuke scaling between these branches of the god tree, or this new god tree, the tree in itself seems to be coming out, and I think that's just because of the fact that it's hand-drawn, or I believe it's mostly hand-drawn, so it has this other sense of movement that's paired with the camera movement as well, and Naruto and Sasuke moving outwards and sort of to the far corner of the frame. I don't know if that makes sense, but in terms of perspective, how they are moving further away from the camera effectively. That, I think, just rides home all the different perspectives we get within the fight. And so the perspectives, I might as well talk about this now, are so dynamic. And the reason for that, I think, is simply for impact. So a great example, I think, of this would be the POV shot, a point of view shot. A point of view shot feels really personal. It's you effectively within someone's position. You are them for that amount of time. We are Naruto effectively for about 2 seconds or a second at least. And then we're completely booted out of that by Sasuke booting or kicking Momoshiki completely out of the frame in this long shot. And that is able to create so much impact because we're moving completely out of it. Similarly to Momoshiki, he didn't see that coming. It creates this sense of shock almost through its visuals. Also, the transition from a lot more wide shots, and when I say wide, I just mean ones which are able to capture all three of them on screen. That also comes from Zhang's cuts as well, when we see Momoshiki then takes out the spear, fending off against Naruto and Sasuke. But then before that, we're taken to a lot more of a flatter perspective, a lot more true to 2D, you can argue, sort of perspective when Naruto engages within this taijutsu battle between Momoshiki. That in itself just looks fantastic. Those contrasts just build on what Till Finning also does towards the end, creating these centers of depth, you can argue, and this is more of a joke, but it feels as if they are literally world building. They are literally creating this environment, and that's something which I also highlighted within my Boruto episodes, that it's the use of the environment which is so good about these fights. There aren't many of them, but it just shows so much attention to detail that even in a space which is effectively isolated, it's just a dimension in itself, is transformed into one which feels so much more than just a dimension. This feels like a combat arena between legends almost. I also want to pick up on the Sakuga from the movie, and I think that the Sakuga from the movie is just incredible as well, and it contains these similar themes which we got from the likes of Well and Zhang until, and it contains some of the same themes which we got from the likes of Well and Zhang until Finning. Two animators which I also want to mention, one which I talk about a decent amount already in relation to our Attack on Titan analysis, that is Arifumi Imai. He's the animation director, if I'm not wrong, of Attack on Titan, up to at least season 3 anyway. I don't know if what's working on season 4 or final season. And then Norio Matsumoto, who animates the beautiful sequence from the movie, which is, again, Naruto Sasuke versus Momoshiki, but it's a different take on it. It's in fact, it's a lot more from the sidewards perspective, as I mentioned when it was on Naruto versus Momoshiki in that little solo taijutsu fight. But what I love about this is that it feels a lot grittier and was able to capture not only just the triumphs of these characters and them overpowering Momoshiki, but he's able to show them struggling against them as well, and also is able to still create that sense of depth. So when one of the characters falls down, Naruto for example, Momoshiki will push him out of the frame, or at least he moves further back from the camera, but he's able to still create that sense of depth, and he's able to return back to that almost flatter perspective and continue the fight. Sasuke does the same thing, and it just keeps rolling and rolling until it almost moves to a vertical downwards perspective. Again, creating so much more dynamism and creating so much versatility is so important. Imai also works on the Naruto-Sasuke combo in relation to the Susanoo Kurama. I wouldn't expect anything else from Imai, he's crazy. He also uses Yutapon cubes. If you're not aware of Yutapon cubes, just refer to Yutaka Nakamura and all of his work in Boku no Hero Academia and Soul Eater. The Yutapon looks really beautiful, how it all comes over the screen as well. Definitely not in a way I think Nakamura would do it. That's not a bad thing. It's not something that Nakamura owns, I don't believe. Just uses it a lot. But also just the transformation, I think, is just next level. There's a lot to say and I can't speak about Sakura forever. I could, but I'm not going to. But the main takeaway which I'm giving to you guys is that there is so much talent working on both editions of this arc. And that is something which should be really appreciated. I know that Boruto, on the whole, specifically its anime, isn't performing in the way of which we once expected, or at least from the manga point of view, how we thought it could play out. However, I don't think we should deny how much talent has gone into at least this arc in itself, even if we just limit that to a technical point of view. So that is all the analysis done for this week. Let's do a quick Link the VA segment and see who is voice acting Momoshiki in the world of anime. If you are new to the podcast, the Link the VA segment is very simple. What I do is I go onto my anime list, find the anime we're looking at in this episode. In this case, we're looking at Boruto. Look up the voice actors from the very show which we're looking at. Find one of those roles. In this case, I'm looking at the voice actor for Momoshiki. And then we look at all the other roles they play in the world of anime. In this case, we are looking at, as I said, the voice actor for Momoshiki, Daisuke Namikawa. Mr. Namikawa plays a lot of roles, as I usually say every episode, but it's true. And so in this version of Link the VA, I think we are pretty lucky. These are three roles two which I'm very familiar with, one which I'm not so familiar with, but I think is probably the funniest. So the three roles which he plays, which I think stood out, were Hohenheim from Fullmetal Alchemist Brotherhood, Oikawa from Haikyuu, and Hisoka from Hunter x Hunter, the 2011 edition. Firstly, I just want to say that I think the funniest part of doing this Link the VA segment, or at least preparing for it, because I do it blind, so when you are listening to this, I kind of just paused the episode. It took about 5 minutes to look at this, and then I'm coming back to you and doing this segment right now. And the funniest part was the videos, or at least two of the videos which I was looking at, just to hear and remind myself of the voices. First off, I just want to say all these voices are incredible and probably some of the voices which are the highlights of their respectable series. I don't know if I can talk that much about Hunter x Hunter because I haven't seen it. Big surprise, I know. But even so, the videos which I watched to listen to these voices was so funny, at least for Oikawa and Hisoka. And the video I used for Hisoka was Hisoka being a pedo compilation. That was so funny to watch. I didn't watch all of it, but I watched like 2 minutes of it and I was laughing all the way through. I just wanted to say that. And then the one for Oikawa I used was every serve because he likes to speak before his serves. I also looked at other moments as well, but the serves, I just realized how repetitive they are. And that's not even a bad thing because I know that repetition does factor into season two, but I laughed so hard when I saw every serve is so uniform and then everyone just goes, every time. It's so hilarious. So just some brief stuff on the voices. I don't think Hohenheim fits into the category that Hisoka and Oikawa are, not in terms of standards, but in terms of just pitch as well as what they represent. Hisoka and Oikawa have this weirdly smooth voice, but I feel like the type of vibe which I get from Hisoka is a confident, no shame sort of voice. I have no shame in looking at Gon and Killua in a really weird way, but I mean, it's that sort of feeling. Whereas Oikawa has a weird, confident, but really smooth voice. That's kind of a facade, but in itself, that is really funny and impressive to witness during conversations throughout the show. Hohenheim is very different in terms of tone. Hohenheim is actually very serious. I don't really get any fun out of him from his voice per se, but it's still a great voice either way. It's kind of just like the voice of reason, which is in your ear throughout the show. And then finally, if the three were to meet, I think we'd have some interesting conversations. I don't think Hohenheim would really want to have a discussion with either Oikawa or Hisoka unless it was truly necessary. Oikawa would act like he wants to have a discussion, I think, but he wouldn't really want to talk to them at all. He probably just wants to practice or do something normal, although I don't know if Hisoka takes place within that volleyball arc of Hunter x Hunter. Again, I'm Hunter x Hunter illiterate at this point. All I know is Nen and a few other things, so forgive me. But maybe they actually could play volleyball, so that could be kind of cool. And then Hisoka would probably try to make conversation because it's Hisoka, but then again would still fail because the other two just don't want to have a conversation. And I don't know if he would dare to have any weird thoughts about Oikawa. I'll let your imaginations do that instead. And so that is the Link the VA segment for this week. Let's pivot onto some more fun stuff, and this will just be what I've been watching as of recent. Here is the In the Moment segment for this week. So recently I've been watching some new things. I've been trying to catch up with many of the movies of 2019 as they're now surfacing, as they take forever to get here to the West anyway. But I've been trying to catch up with many of the movies of 2019, one of them being Heroes Rising, obviously. My Hero Academia Heroes Rising, I spoke about that last episode. I think I'm not really going to discuss on the podcast very soon. I might make a backlog review, which I've already prepared, so I might just throw that out when there's an off week. But I think I found my favorite film of 2019, and I know I think I said Ride Your Wave was at one point, but I've kind of changed my opinion. I know I also said Promare, but that was a time where I didn't even see many of the movies of 2019, so that was kind of invalid. But anyway, so I think my favorite film of 2019 now has been Kaiju no Kodomo, or also known as Children of the Sea. There have been some complaints about this movie, and there have been some criticisms in regards to the movie, and I understand them, I think they're fair, but honestly, I really did enjoy this film. I'm not going to go into the plot of the film per se, because I know not everyone has seen it, and particularly in the West as well, it's not particularly a big thing, but I do think this movie is very strong, and the reason for that is because it does something which I really love, and that is transcending and challenging narrative. I speak a lot about challenging narrative and structures. We even spoke about it in today's episode in regards to Kaguya and Naruto, but in the case of Kaiju no Kodomo, it challenges itself almost. It challenges itself as a story, and it does that by going further. I think one of the main themes of this thing is the environment in itself and our responsibility for the environment. And so it decides to go a lot further than just what the story is about, and decides to challenge what is its place, what is this story's place within the wider world, and what is our responsibility in regards to the environment. I don't know, and I'm not a pro when it comes to anything like ecologist philosophy or environmentalism or anything like that, but from what I understand of it at least, that very same notion of responsibility and who we are in regards to our environment, what is our place within our environment, what do we need to do for it? Those are questions, I think, which are also answered within that sort of realm of philosophy. It also answers and asks questions such as what are beauty, and also what is the danger or potentially fear of beauty. Notions of like the sublime and those sorts of philosophies are ones which are definitely sort of, at least from what I understood of it, incorporated within the film. Also from a technical point of view, I think it's done quite well. We have a really nice combination of 3D CGI mixed in with these hand-drawn pieces. Really interesting character acting as well, and there's a lot of water. For some reason, I don't know how, the Watanabe, I don't mean Shinichiro Watanabe, I mean Ayumu Watanabe, the director of this film, Yusa and Shinkai, all in the same year, decided to make films based on water. I don't know how. Why did they all decide to put water films in the same year? I just don't get it, but it's really funny anyway. But there's a lot of water, there's a lot of interesting parts, which it does take a lot of attention, and it's not for everyone. I know not everyone will enjoy or maybe appreciate this film because of that challenge. Not everyone enjoys that challenge. Some people just prefer the cyclical narrative, but the ending is something which I think is a lot more impactful and needed, as opposed to one which simply just resolves itself. Because this isn't a story which simply resolves, or an issue that resolves. This is something which is ongoing right now in today's political climate almost. But that's really it. So let's end the Indie Moment segment. Thank you for listening. If you did enjoy this episode, feel free to go onto iTunes or Apple Podcasts and review the show. Let's just go to some closing thoughts for this week. What did I think of the Momoshiki arc, and just some takeaways from this analysis today? So, what do I think of the Momoshiki arc? I like it. I like the Momoshiki arc a lot. It's a really good and interesting way to get into Boruto. With a nice transition, it doesn't feel overbearing and full of information. It simply just reintroduces and repackages information for us. This is the same with its themes, but it's also introducing these universal themes which we are expected to remember, or at least we are reminded of. It's the notion that the infinite pursuit of power and desperation for power isn't a healthy approach. We see that through the downfall of Momoshiki, we see that in the downfall of Boruto, arguably. Themes which are once introduced and perpetuated with the likes of Naruto Shippuden and the original Naruto series. From a technical point of view, this is very competent. I think this is probably my favorite. I think the Momoshiki arc, or at least the Momoshiki arcs from both the movie and the anime, have some of my favorite sakuga of a really long time, or at least combat sakuga from a really long time. So much talent has gone into this, and a lot of talent and a decent amount of thought has gone into this introductory arc, and that is why I think it is so successful. Thank you for listening to this episode of Gets in the Mecha. That has been episode 34. Apologies for it being late. It's been a really tough week to record, not because particularly time, but the amount of being drained, it just wouldn't make for a good episode because my voice would be croaked, and I don't really want to give you guys a lacking episode. I still want to give you a full-on episode, which you come to Gets in the Mecha for. I think I really did reinterpret my view of the Momoshiki arc from what was I don't want to say average, but it was decent. But now I really do enjoy this arc genuinely because it has a lot of resonance, and it's really difficult, I think, to just ease someone into a show that is trying to pull off these new things. And because they're so attached to their previous show, how do you slowly just introduce them to a new sort of way of looking at things within the new show which you're creating, or new manga which you're creating? But that is all for this week. Thank you for listening. I have been your host, Jamal, today, and this has been Get in the Mecha. The music in this production goes as follows: Forever by Alex McCulloch, 8-Bit Title Screen by Joth, Mandatory Overtime by Joth, Go Lucky by Chasers Gaming, Difference by Chasers Gaming, and Anomaly by Eric Medea's UndersoundImage.org.